Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 20th of July, these are our main stories. President Trump sends an assistant for the figures during an interview about coronavirus.
I think it's the opposite. I think we have one of the lowest mortality
rates
in the world.
That's not true, sir.
We're going to take a look.
We had 900 deaths on a single day.
I heard we had one of the lowest, maybe the lowest mortality rate anywhere in the world.
China denies a mass sterilization program of Uyghur Muslim women. No agreement yet between EU leaders on pandemic aid money for member countries. Also in this podcast,
it's about time. Finally, the feminist revolution in Egypt has begun.
How a high-profile case of sexual violence in Egypt has sparked a Me Too movement. And the United Arab Emirates launches its first ever mission to Mars. We begin in the United States, where the number of deaths from COVID-19 has passed 140,000, almost a quarter of the total worldwide. Meanwhile, President Trump has said his country is the envy of the world when it comes to testing for the coronavirus. He was responding to questions in an interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday, and he dismissed the figures from Johns Hopkins University, which has been monitoring death rates worldwide.
When you talk about mortality rates, I think it's the opposite. I think we have one of the lowest mortality rates in the world.
We're going to take a look. We had 900 deaths on a single day.
We will take a look.
This week.
Ready?
You can check it out.
Could you please get me the mortality rate?
Yeah.
Kaylee's right here. I heard we had one of the lowest, maybe the lowest mortality rate anywhere in the world. Do you have the numbers, please? Because I heard we had the best mortality rate.
The case rate of similarly situated countries, as Dr. Birx points out.
Number one low mortality rate.
A number of U.S. states, mainly in the South, are experiencing a surge in infections. But President Trump said the recent rise in national case numbers was due to increased testing.
Many of those cases are young people that would heal in a day. They have the sniffles and we put it down as a test. Many of them, don't forget, I guess it's like 99.7%. People are going to get better. And in many cases, they're going to get better very quickly. We go out and we look, and then on the news, look, if you go back to the news, all of your, even your wonderful competitors, you'll see cases are up. Well, cases are up. Many of those cases shouldn't even be cases. Cases are up because we have the best testing in the world, and we have the most testing. Right. No country has ever done what we've done in terms of testing. We are the envy of the world, they call, and they say the most incredible job anybody's done is our job on testing.
I asked our U.S. correspondent Peter Bowes what he made of President Trump's rejection of the science on mortality rates.
Well, for weeks now, President Trump has been saying that the U.S. is doing much better than other countries dealing with the virus. But the statistics from Johns Hopkins University, reputable source, simply do not back him up. And you heard the argument during that interview between the interviewer and the president and his PR assistant coming on to try to produce the facts that back up the president's case. But it's clear that those numbers simply don't add up, and more people are dying from the disease here than in some of the other countries with a high number of cases, like Brazil and Russia. It is fair to say that the US has a lower mortality rate than some other countries like the UK and Mexico, but to his claim that it's one of the lowest or possibly the lowest, that isn't backed up by the facts.
Does he have a point? It's a point he keeps making about the number of tests being done leading to more positive results.
Well, clearly that is the case in terms of pure numbers, but they are not telling the full story. So the most significant statistic is the positivity rate. That's the number of people found to have the disease as a percentage of those were tested. So it doesn't matter whether you're testing 100 people or 1,000, it's the proportion of those tested that turn out to be positive that's significant. And that number in many states is rising. And President Trump says, as we've just heard, that he believes most of those are young people having the sniffles that will very quickly get better. What the health experts are saying is that may well be the case, but those people have the potential to pass the virus on to others, older people in their family, who may not fare so well.
Is he worried the pandemic could affect his chances of being re-elected in November?
Well, it is clear that the Trump administration response to the virus will be central to the election. He is a shrewd operator. He watches the opinion polls very closely. So you'd think he must be very well aware of what's happening right now in terms of this virus will have a bearing on his chances to win the next election. Interestingly, there's a Fox News poll, opinion poll out today. Fox News wants the president saying his favourite channel. He says he doesn't believe their opinion poll that shows that the virus is the top issue to voters, and half of them, the poll says, disapprove of how President Trump is handling it.
Peter Bowes in Los Angeles. The Chinese ambassador to London has denied that China is carrying out an orchestrated campaign to forcibly sterilise Muslim Uyghur women in its western Xinjiang region. However, during an interview on BBC television, Liu Xiaoming was shown recorded testimony of a Uyghur woman who said she'd been made to undergo an operation to make her infertile.
First of all, there's no so-called, you know, pervasive, massive forced sterilization among Uyghur people in China. It's totally against the truth. Government policy strongly opposed to this kind of practice. But I cannot rule out, you know, single cases for any country. A single case.
So you can't rule out the fact it's happening at all. There is a general view.
But the general policy is that is not a government policy. General view is we treat every ethnic group in China as equal.
The UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab accused China of gross and egregious human rights abuses and said sanctions against those responsible could not be ruled out. So how much notice will China take of this condemnation? I put that question to Vincent Ni from the BBC's Chinese service.
China is not foreign to any accusations of its human rights record. You know, the Western criticism of China's human rights record has been there for a long time. So I suppose, you know, this allegation against the Chinese over the violation of, you know, human rights of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang is also quite normal to a lot of Chinese people, the kind of, you know, criticism. But I guess what the party was trying to suggest in China is that despite criticism, the building of these vocational training centers has achieved its goals, which is to reduce terrorism. So the Chinese ambassador this morning also very keenly highlighted the fact that there wasn't any terrorist attack in the last few years, thanks to all these people being sent to re-education centers. So what I'm trying to suggest, Alex, is that the narrative is certainly very different in China from the one in the West.
Why does China think that Britain is raising this?
Well, I think if you listen to what the Chinese state media is saying, what's happening in the US is certainly having a huge impact on the decisions of the UK. So the Chinese state media was very keen to highlight that UK is just closely following Donald Trump's lead for various reasons. And I suppose, you know, this is also not surprising to the Chinese because, you know, with what's happening in Hong Kong and the UK's response following the imposition of the national security law. So, you know, the Chinese state wouldn't want to be seen as doing something wrong. So their response is that UK is simply just following the Americans' lead.
The UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab is expected to make an announcement. And if it's more sanctions, will China care?
Well, I guess the effectiveness of sanctions is up to debate because, you know, the Americans have imposed the sanctions Magnitsky Act. And whether or not the UK is going to follow, I think there is still a question. But what's certainly very true is that, you know, according to various reports this afternoon, the UK is going to and its extradition treaty with Hong Kong. And this is also going to be, you know, evidence in Beijing that the UK is again following the Americans' lead. So, you know, the story being told in mainland China is certainly very different from the story we know of outside of mainland China.
Vincent Ni of the BBC Chinese Service. The first mission to Mars by an Arab nation has lifted off from a site in Japan. The rocket is sending a United Arab Emirates probe into the orbit of the Red Planet to learn more about its atmosphere and weather. It's part of a plan to help the UAE move away from oil and gas production and enter the global space industry. I asked our science correspondent Jonathan Amos when it would be clear whether the launch has been a success.
Yeah, Alex, so far so good. The rocket's got quite a bit of work still to do to get the probe away from Earth. So it'll be about an hour, maybe an hour and a half before we get any sort of signal from the HOPE probe to say, I'm on my way. And that will be the time, I guess, when those technicians in the UAE who have been following the launch will breathe something of a sigh of relief to know that they are heading towards the Red Planet. So still a bit of work to do. And we keep our fingers crossed.
It's got quite a journey ahead of it. All going well, what will the mission be like?
Well, it'll be nerve-shredding, I think, for the UAE. I mean, there is a small select band that have done this. It's just the United States, Europe, Russia and India who've managed to get satellites into orbit around the Red Planet. A lot of missions have failed down the years. It's something like 50-50. I mean, those statistics are a little unfair in the sense that we've got better at it. A lot of the failures were right at the beginning of the history of space exploration. Many of the current batch of missions tend to succeed. The failures tend to be a lot rarer now. But nonetheless, for the UAE, this is a remarkable achievement if they can pull it off. Not least because they've built this probe very quickly from a standing start. In just 6 years, they've had the help of the Americans, some American universities who have the expertise of building spacecraft hardware and instruments and sending them to planets. They've assisted the UAE, and so we are hopeful that they will pull it off.
As you say, there have been several Mars missions already. Why does the UAE want to join the club?
They're very keen to try and get more of their young people into the technical subjects in schools and at university. This is a country, it's a very young country. Next year, when this probe arrives at Mars, it'll be celebrating its 50th anniversary, and it's been built on oil and gas. And they recognise that they need to move towards a knowledge economy, and this is on that road.
Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos. Egypt is experiencing its own Me Too moment after scores of women took to social media to accuse a male student of multiple sexual assaults. The student, who denies the charges, was arrested, and a few days later, the cabinet approved amendments to a law that would ensure anonymity for victims of sexual abuse. This case and the response to it is seen as a turning point in the fight against sexual violence in a country where victims often get the blame. Crassie Twigg from BBC Monitoring reports.
No means no.
Egyptian TV host Amr Adib stating in no uncertain terms what a man should do if his sexual advances are turned down. This may not seem like a controversial statement, but to some it represents a shift in attitudes following a flood of accusations against an Egyptian university student.
There's been like scores of hashtags come out over the past few days, one of them calling for the beginning of a feminist revolution in Egypt.
Joanna Saba from the BBC monitoring team in Cairo has been following the reaction.
It's the first time that we've seen the pressure grow to the point where it's actually translated into action on the part of the authorities. And more importantly, I think it's really changing the conversation surrounding this.
The young man was arrested days after the first accusations emerged. And that swift action was seen as remarkable in a country that's been criticised for its poor track record of punishing sexual violence. And the support for the accusers on social and mainstream media was seen by many as a watershed moment.
It's about time. Finally, the feminist revolution in Egypt has begun.
Egyptian feminist author Mona El-Dahawi is among those happy to see the momentum, and for her it's personal, and goes back to the revolution of 2011, a moment marred by sexual assaults on female protesters.
We have a criminal justice system in Egypt that is criminally unjust. And my case is a reminder of that. I was sexually assaulted and I had my arms broken by the police. Egypt is the perfect reminder that the state holds a monopoly on violence.
A UN report from 2013 said that over 99% of women surveyed said they had experienced some form of sexual harassment. And this is the sort of thing they are up against. This is the well-known Islamic televangelist Abdullah Rushdie saying a woman's scandalous clothing can excite a young man's instincts. But in a departure from previous rhetoric, Egypt's top Islamic institution Al-Azhar rejected the view that women's clothing or behavior was to blame. In another development welcomed by activists, the government approved amendments to a law that would guarantee anonymity for victims of sexual abuse. But prominent women's rights campaigner Mohsen Hassan warns that it can be applied selectively.
It's still conditioned, and having it conditioned that it has the right for the judge or the prosecution to have information public, and sometimes it's problematic. Generally, that there are good women and other bad women, so those good women, they deserve our protection. And seeing other bad women who don't deserve this, like TikTok women.
Mohsen Hassan was referring there to several young TikTok stars who were arrested in recent months on accusations of promoting prostitution. This social media campaign has put a spotlight on an issue activists have fought over for many years. It's a cause for measured optimism among Me Too campaigners. But somewhere there's the realization that it's just one step in a long and difficult journey.
That report by Crassi Twigg from BBC Monitoring. The health authorities in Bangladesh say the number of people being tested for the coronavirus has almost halved following a fake screening scandal. More than a dozen people, including a hospital owner in Dhaka, have been arrested. They're alleged to have issued bogus certificates to thousands of patients. Here's our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etarajan.
There were 18,000 tests being carried out each day in late June in Bangladesh, but that's fallen to just over 10,000 in the past 2 weeks. Experts say there is increasing public distrust of testing following the scandal. Those arrested are accused of issuing bogus certificates to people, including migrant workers. Their employers in Europe needed the papers before allowing them to return to work. Earlier this month, Italy stopped flights from Bangladesh after dozens of workers who arrived from Dhaka had tested positive. Bangladeshi officials admit that the scandal has dealt a huge blow to the country's image.
Anbarasan Etarajan. Still to come in this podcast, we hear from the winner of the hot dog eating tournament in the US who swallowed 75 dogs in the allocated 10 minutes.
I knew I was fast in the beginning. It was like blistering speed. The dogs were cooked really well today. Minute like six is where I really missed the crowd because they're pumped up. I hit a wall and it took me a little bit more work to get through it. Yeah, this is a crazy year and I'm happy I was able to get a record.
As we record this podcast, European Union leaders are still holding intense negotiations about a huge coronavirus recovery package and the bloc's next long-term budget. They're at a summit that had to be extended for a third day. Differences remain over what part of coronavirus funds should be in non-repayable grants and what, if any, conditions should apply to EU aid. Luxembourg's Prime Minister Xavier Bettel said that in his 7 years in office he'd rarely seen such diametrically opposed positions. A group of five countries, grown from four since Saturday with Finland joining them, are insisting that the aid should be in the form of conditional loans rather than non-repayable grants. One of these countries is Austria, and its Chancellor Sebastian Kurz said there was still some way to go.
In summe, bin ich nach wie vor optimistisch, dass wir eine Lösung finden.
Overall, I'm still optimistic that we can find a solution. I believe that where there's a will, there's a way. I think it is possible to get a result at this summit, but yes, even though it is the third day, there's still a way to go.
Ein Stück weit Weg zu gehen.
Our Europe correspondent Gavin Lee has the latest on what looks like a further long night of negotiations.
This summit has become one of the longest in two decades. 35 hours of face-to-face talks clocked up and still counting, with no deal yet in sight. It started with the best intentions and optimism that leaders would agree on a plan to raise 750 billion euros to help steer Europe through a deep recession caused by the coronavirus. But there have been deep divisions and personal name-calling over the refusal by Austria, Sweden, the Netherlands, Denmark and Finland to allow 500 billion euros to be distributed in the form of grants. One of the five, the Netherlands, is also pushing to attach extra conditions and the ability to veto requests for money. That has angered the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, who told reporters that the Dutch guy was the one to blame. The Bulgarian Prime Minister said his Dutch colleague, Mark Rutte, thought he was the policeman of Europe. Tiredness has led to tempers flaring and diplomacy, like the masks they came in with, slipping.
Gavin Lee in Brussels. This week, Boris Johnson reaches the end of his first year as the UK's Prime Minister. What promised to be a premiership anchored on taking the UK out of the European Union has, like everything else on the planet, been pushed to extremes by the coronavirus pandemic. The BBC's Edward Sturton looks at 12 eventful months for the occupant of number 10 Downing Street.
Young's kicks through, Sexton should get this, he doesn't, and England have scored!
The ball came loose from the back of a scrum. Of course, it'd be a great, great thing to have a crack at.
It was a characteristically flamboyant metaphor. As things turned out, the ball coming loose at the back of the scrum was a pretty accurate description of what happened. Theresa May's authority was simply broken by Brexit, and Tory MPs, many of whom were certainly not natural Johnson fans, swung behind him.
I give notice that Boris Johnson is elected as the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party.
It was clear pretty quickly that this was not going to be business as usual at Westminster. In September last year, the new administration suspended Parliament in the run-up to the date scheduled for Britain's departure from the European Union. The Supreme Court ruled that
the prorogation was void and of no effect.
The row over prorogation didn't stop Mr Johnson's determination to, in a phrase that became all too familiar, get Brexit done. Guido Harry worked for Boris Johnson when he was Mayor of London.
He got us through, I guess, and he delivered on something that most of us didn't think was deliverable.
Well, my friends, good morning, everybody, my friends. Well, we did it. We did it. We pulled it off, didn't we?
The winner takes it all.
The Tory majority he won in December was the biggest they'd enjoyed since Margaret Thatcher's victory in 1987. At the end of January, Britain left the European Union. Mr Johnson was able to claim that he'd got Brexit done.
The UK has officially left the European Union, bringing to an end more than 3.5 years of political turbulence.
That same day's headlines, around 6 months after Mr Johnson moved into Downing Street, included this.
Health officials are trying to find anyone who's had close contact with two Chinese tourists being treated in Newcastle for the coronavirus.
I was at a hospital the other night where I think there were actually a few coronavirus patients, and I shook hands with everybody.
That was on the 3rd of March. Nearly 3 weeks later, the message was rather different.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
The timing of the lockdown is likely to be at the heart of a future inquiry into the COVID crisis. Guido Harry.
There was an issue with his instincts. Every bone in his body is telling him not to intervene in the lives of ordinary people more than is absolutely necessary.
The Prime Minister has been taken to intensive care after his coronavirus symptoms worsened.
The last weeks of Mr Johnson's first year in office have been marked by a series of U-turns.
The government has U-turned on free school meals.
The NHS is ditching its bespoke coronavirus contact tracing app in favour of one developed by Apple and Google.
From face coverings shouldn't be compulsory in shops in England to perhaps they should to they will.
The year Boris Johnson has had, changed jobs, moved house, had a baby, broke the mould with winning a general election, is taking us out of the European Union, all of that is massive.
Guido Harry.
And then COVID comes along and, you know, blindsides him.
The word rollercoaster doesn't begin to describe this first year in office. One thing hasn't changed, however. Boris Johnson continues to divide opinion more radically than anyone else in our politics today.
Edward Sturton with that report. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has visited Hagia Sophia in Istanbul days ahead of the first Muslim prayers to be held there since the 1930s. Earlier this month, he decreed that the building be changed back to a mosque after a court annulled its status as a museum. Here's our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Friday prayers in Hagia Sophia will be a moment of huge symbolism for President Erdogan, whose roots lie in political Islam. He and his entourage inspected carpets that will be rolled out for Muslim worshippers. Mr. Erdogan's decree has been welcomed in parts of the Islamic world, but has been denounced by most Christian denominations. Hagia Sophia was originally built as a Christian cathedral, before being converted to a mosque in the 15th century after the Ottoman conquest. It was made a secular museum by Kemal Atatürk, the founder of Turkey's modern republic.
Danny Eberhardt. Consuming fast food might not seem like an obvious form of exercise, but an American scientist says that competitive eaters have shown an improvement in performance that dwarfs other athletic achievements. Dr. James Smoliga from High Point University in North Carolina tracked data from the hot dog eating contest in Coney Island over four decades. This report from Richard Hamilton.
And we are underway the 2020 men's division of the Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest.
Commentary from the American Sports Network ESPN of this year's Hot Dog Eating Contest on the 4th of July. Travel restrictions decreased the number of competitors, so there were only five men and five women taking part. And they stood 2 meters away from each other and were separated by Perspex screens. Joey Jaws Chestnut won the competition and broke his own record by swallowing 75 hot dogs in 10 minutes to claim the mustard belt.
It's very lame, but I'm going to do it verbally now. Joey Jaws Chestnut, greatest athlete in the world.
I knew I was fast in the beginning. It was like blistering speed. The dogs were cooked really well today. Minute like six is where I really missed the crowd because they're pumped up. I hit a wall, and it took me a little bit more work to get through it. Yeah, this is a crazy year, and I'm happy I was able to get a record. And being inside helped. I did train a little bit more this year, so.
Well, congratulations.
And describing a man who scoffs fast food for a living as an athlete may not actually be that far off the mark. Dr. James Smoliga was watching last year's contest when he had an idea. Could he apply the mathematical equations which are used to estimate the limits of athletic performance to feats of gluttony? Based on data from 152 competitors over 39 years, Dr. Smoliga calculated that sausage-eating capacity has improved by a staggering 700%. Compare that to the improvement rate in track and field sports, which is around 40%. He also worked out that the hot dog improvement rate would level off at an upper limit of 83 bangers and buns in 10 minutes.
I hit a wall when I did a marathon about 80% of the way through. It's interesting that you can hit a wall eating hot dogs. Richard Hamilton with that report. Finally, in this podcast, the world of Irish dancing, but not as you know it. That's the sound of 21-year-old Morgan Bullock, an African-American Irish dancer, performing her steps to Beyoncé's latest song, Savage. Morgan posted the video on the social media platform TikTok, where she went viral. Most of the comments were overwhelmingly positive, but some accused the young dancer of cultural appropriation. Now, Riverdance has called. Here's Morgan talking to the BBC's digital video team.
I mean, my understanding of the term is that it means when you're taking something from another culture, claiming it as your own without recognizing where it comes from. And that's couldn't be further from what I'm doing. Like, it's important for people to recognize that there's a difference between appropriation and appreciation. I think people use the term appropriation without knowing what it really means.
After the video went viral, Morgan was invited onto a very popular Irish radio show where she was surprised by Padraig Moyles, the lead dancer of Riverdance.
If you're up for it, we'd love you to join us in Vienna, Virginia to perform in Riverdance.
Oh my God. Oh, I would love to do that. My heart just dropped.
I think you're going to do an amazing job. I know
it was unreal. Riverdance is like the end goal for me with dancing. So the opportunity to perform with Riverdance is amazing.
Thank you for having the guts in many ways to put yourself out there. And you are unique in terms of what you showed on that video. And
it's been postponed, so I'm not sure about the dates for the U.S. tour, but I mean, I'll be there whenever it is.
And if you want to see more of Irish dancer Morgan Bullock in action, you can watch her dancing and that full interview on the BBC website. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.